Wilkins and Jan Harrison in the audience.
Yeah.
Very good. Would you please come up and get these? We have something for you to fill out that has to be turned in. Huh? We weren't checking on you, Jan.
You have H, right? And Jen has A. They have to be back in about 3:30 tomorrow.
Give them all. What would you do?
We have one major announcement, well, a couple of important things that we'd like for students to please take note of. On your course outline sheet that we gave you during the first session, we had an exam scheduled for April the 4th. The exam will not be April the 4th, and we hope that all TAs will take note of this also. The exam will not be April the 4th. April the 4th, which is next Wednesday, we will have Alex Poinsett, senior staff editor for Ebony Magazine from Chicago, Illinois, will be our guest speaker. If you will be checking bulletin boards towards the latter part of this week, you will see posters and advertisement out on Mr. Alex Poinsett. The exam will follow your first class discussion group following spring break, which, you know, spring break runs from April 14th to April 23rd, I believe it is. Okay, so please take note of that. If you have any further questions about that, you may contact your TAs or come by Afro-American Studies office. We'd like to remind you that we have moved into a new textbook. And that textbook is Frazier's book. You are to read part one is the required reading assignment. Those of you who did not find Frazier or Yet's book, The Choice, in the Illini Union bookstore previously, it is there now. They recently got in quite a large number of both books, so please go on and pick your books up. The other thing is one of the students left a college algebra book in this building, in this room, the last time we met here. If you have lost the college algebra book, please go by Afro-American Studies office on Chalmers Street and ask the secretary to give you your book. We'd like for you to have it. Students in my discussion session may pick up the handouts which I mentioned to you Wednesday in the Afro-American Studies office, 512 East Chalmers, Friday afternoon. Please go by sometimes after 1 o'clock on Friday and pick up those handouts. I'd also like to announce at this time that the reception for Professor Hamilton, the student reception for Professor Hamilton, will follow this lecture discussion, and it will be held in Flag Hall, the crib. Okay? We'd like for all students, of course, to go over there and to personally get to meet with Professor Hamilton. At this time, I'd like to introduce Columbo Keepler, who is a second-year law student here at the University of Illinois. He is also a TA for the 199 Black Visiting Scholar Lecture Series, and he, in turn, will introduce our speaker for tonight, Keepler.
This is the third lecture in this series of lectures that we've had. And we have with us tonight Professor Charles Hamilton, who is a political science professor at Columbia University. He's not only a political scientist, but he's also an attorney. I myself and a couple of my colleagues are pursuing that particular career now. And particular thing in terms of some of the talk, some of the things that I've heard him say today to me and to several other people in a couple of classes that he's gone around to, I think becomes very, very interesting to us, and especially in terms of some of the other lecturers that we've had, in terms of Mr. Cockrell and in terms of Mayor Hatcher. I think basically the reason why, in terms of my own perspective, as to why we should be discussing or should be understanding why we should be establishing institutions, that is, economical institutions and social institutions, you know, I think it comes right back to the same old question about our blackness or what have you, you know. The need for an institution, that is, an institution that is captioned black or that's under the penumbra of blackness or what have you, arises basically because this is same old, still the same old racist society. Otherwise, I don't think that we would even have to begin to start to think about creating alternative institutions or what have you. Well, with that in mind or what have you, I think also that one organizes or creates institutions or what have you. I think implicit in the definition of institution is some kind of organization. And implicit in the definition of some kind of organization is organization for a purpose. And implicit in the organization for a purpose is strength. Now, one of the things that we have lacked in terms of our history here the past 350 years or what have you has to deal with that very, very elemental fact that might is right in this particular country. So Professor Hamilton is going to talk to us tonight about establishing black institutions in terms of economical, in terms of viable, economical viable institutions as well as socially viable institutions. I don't think that I need to say that much more. I think in terms of his background, in terms of his expertise or what have you, in terms of what he has to give to us, I don't think that the man has come here to blow our minds out. You know, I think a lot of us reacted in terms, at least my class reacted viscerally in terms of Cockrell, in that he sort of like blew some of us out, you know, that we really didn't get a hang on what he was saying. In terms of some of the papers that I received from my class, the students were saying that I don't understand, or the language that he used is something that I just don't understand what he was talking about. So I would caution you tonight to sit back and listen, that is, for understanding rather than for to be blown out. Above and beyond that, I just bring you Professor Cockrell, or Dr. Cockrell, you know. And Dr. Cockrell is not here, you know. I'm sorry, I'm bringing you Dr. Hamilton.
Thank you. Two things. I'm glad you changed it, because I really didn't want to come out of a Marxist bag tonight. I haven't checked on that recently. Secondly, you won't have any trouble with understanding what I have to say. It's terribly simplistic, I assure you. I may have difficulty with it. Not too long ago, 4 years in fact, a study was conducted in the Northeast metropolitan area, a study on civic education in three types of schools. The three schools studied were an upper class white junior high school, a lower middle class blue collar white junior high school, and a black upper lower class junior high school. Now, the three schools had many of the characteristics one would expect. The first school, characterized by high family income, large percentage of the students going on to college, large percentage of the students with reading scores above the national average, and so forth. But these kinds of characteristics were not the major concerns of the particular research. Rather, the study was primarily interested in the type of civic education materials each school developed. The researchers examined a number of things. They looked at instructional materials used in the schools, the kinds of assignments given to students for research term papers, the types of assembly programs held at the schools. They did a content analysis of the speeches by the principals and superintendents and commencement speakers. Now, in the first school, there was a great deal of emphasis on developing knowledge about how laws are made in the Congress, in the executive branch, even a discussion of the role of interest groups, corporate power structures, labor unions, the courts. And a very frequent theme in opening day assemblies and on other occasions was a theme of training for leadership. You will be the leaders of tomorrow. A constant iteration that a good citizen assumes his share of leadership. Thus, it's important to learn and assimilate the rules of governance in the society. The rules must be absorbed, the rules must be nurtured and preserved. And when the school invited outside speakers, they invariably consisted of state legislators, local chamber of commerce member leaders, local Rotary Club types. And their speeches, which were taped and subsequently analyzed, reveal a heavy dose of the notion that this is your society, you will take over from your parents and so forth, you are the leaders who will carry on, and a heavy emphasis not only on local but on national leadership. So leadership, governance, these were the dominant themes of the civic education program in this first particular upper-class white school. Now, the study, as I said, looked at a lower middle-class school. Most of the students were from homes of blue-collar factory workers. The school normally sent graduates to high school, but then mainly to the local junior college. In those cases where the students did enter a two-year community college, they were, of course, more frequently than not, first-generation college students. The same kinds of materials and data were gathered as in the first school: audio-visual aids, analyses of assembly programs, talks by the principal and others. But in this school, the second type of school, instead of an emphasis on leadership and governance, there was a decided emphasis on participation and duty. A good citizen votes in every election. A good citizen joins the local PTA and contributes to the United Fund. A good citizen listens to all sides and then makes up his or her mind. In other words, the thrust of this curricula was to socialize a student to a point of seeing herself or himself as one who participates in local voluntary activities. The good father agrees to manage a little league baseball team. The good mother agrees to become a den mother. Very little emphasis on how laws are passed and implemented. Some emphasis, surely, but not nearly as much as in the first school. And when speakers were invited to the second school, they tended to be the local Red Cross volunteer, or a member of the League of Women Voters, or a representative from one of the local private social welfare agencies. The single word these people used most often was involved. When you grow up, become involved in your community. Be active. Be involved in civic matters. But this was usually, of course, followed up by examples of voluntary involvement in after-work activities, evening PTAs and so forth, or community activities of a voluntary nature during the day, such as contributing an hour or so a week to help others who are sick and unable to care for themselves, unquote. In fact, one almost had a duty to come to the voluntary aid of one's neighbor. The emphasis here was always in the local community. So in the first school, leadership, governance. In the second school, participation, involvement. The third school was all black, and what is called, of course, an inner city school. with all the economic characteristics generally associated with such schools. Well, what did a study of the civic education curriculum reveal at that institution? There was a clear, discernible emphasis on obedience to law. A good citizen respects and obeys the laws, serves in the military service of his country, pays his taxes. There's no question that the materials contained a lesson plan on Congress makes the law, but not at all to the extent found in the other schools, especially the first school. And persons, what types of persons were invited to the school to speak? Well, they were generally people such as the community relations police officer, the local army recruiting sergeant. And in every one of the 11 to 12 speeches analyzed, speeches made by all kinds of persons at the school assemblies in the third school, not one ever mentioned that the students could even conceivably be the leaders of tomorrow. There was, interestingly enough, more emphasis in the materials in this school than in the other two on the necessity of a good citizen to pay one's taxes, if not cheerfully, then certainly promptly and correctly. Now, I suspect that there's not one person in this room who, while you may not have known of the particular study I'm commenting on, certainly could have predicted the research findings. We have, I'm suggesting, as a society, convinced ourselves that education per se is a clear and definite vehicle or route for upward mobility. The fact is that many of our educational institutions, our systems, and much of our conscious and unconscious practice directly serve to support and perpetuate socioeconomic class and racial stratification in this society. Those children in those three schools were being socialized into an acceptance of their roles in society. Those black children were not being encouraged to aspire to leadership, but to obedience to law. Now, the topic or the theme of, as I understand it, of this session is establishing black identity through social and economic institutions. I would suggest, and I want to make a distinction between institutions and programs. I would suggest that programs might be able to begin to address themselves to some of the kinds of problems described in that study. But basically, I would suggest that institutions are the only viable long-term answers. Now, let me distinguish between the two. By institutions, I will mean those structures, agencies, units, groupings, and so forth, that are usually slowly built up in a society, which embody not only specific agendas of action, but strong ideological and theoretical notions and values. Norms, normative values must enthuse institutions. Members support and nurture institutions primarily because of their identity with and attachment to the norms of those institutions, whether the particular agendas of the moment are accepted or not. Institutions, as I use it, survive brief historical moments and contribute to the long-term stability and growth of their members. Institutions, then, are characterized not only by normative values, but by their protracted nature. In addition, of course, institutions that are most viable are those that most intimately reflect the cultural experience and nuances of their members. Thus, for example, one might say the political institution or system of the two-party system is rather entirely dysfunctional for a society like Tanzania. Programs, on the other hand, are more immediate, more subject to the jerks of the moment. programs are addressed to rather specific needs at a given time. Thus, manpower training programs, remedial reading programs, drug rehabilitation programs. Programs can be and often are far more pragmatic and flexible than institutions. And as I think on the theme of this lecture series, I think that black people have devoted more than a small amount of time to program development, but only a relatively minimum amount of time to institution building. And this has been quite understandable. Black people have had to respond always to immediate crisis issues. And more frequently than not, that response has taken the form of specific programs. But a programmatic response has its advantages and disadvantages. Positively, it permits action now. It creates motion. It gets things done, or moving at least. But a disadvantage, and it's probably not avoidable, is that programs are virtually always one, terminal, and two, externally supported. That is, most black programs which are perceived, conceived, and developed as programs have been developed on a soft money economy, that is, grants, public or private. And of course, all grants are temporary. Thus, structuring programs to deal with black economic and social development is useful, but exceptionally limited. We can develop programs to raise the reading levels and inform of the dangers of drugs, and these will be absolutely good. They are important and necessary, but they are programs. And therefore, they are by definition seriously limited. In addition, we know clearly that program money from outside, whether from the federal government or Ford, such money is being cut back now. And this is, I think, understandable. We knew or should have known of the possibility of this, so therefore we should have assumed its probability at some point. Now, the implications of this is that blacks are going to be required once again, and I say once again because I refer to the post-Reconstruction period, to spend much more time than we've had to spend recently and much more talent looking inward for institution building. This might not be too bad. In fact, I would suggest that it might be one of the unanticipated positive consequences of this time of austerity. By this I mean with not so much money around now for programs, perhaps all those blacks who were hustling the black thing from the late 60s on will drop out now. And all those whites who were feeding at the trough will be required to go someplace else now. And I think, in all candor, if we admit it, that if the last decade produced anything, it certainly produced a whole spate of pimps and paternalists. Now, as soft money program funds dry up, become scarce, not readily available, some blacks will be released to get on with the fundamentally serious business of attempting to build institutions. This means that we will have to spend more time cultivating each other. Now, I see substantially two routes to this process of institution building. The first clearly relies exclusively on the internal resources for initiating and generating any sustained movement. And the best model here in black history, I would suggest, would be the black church. This model or route clearly reaches outside itself for help, assistance, and aid, but its very survival does not depend on that external help. It has its own built-in economic infrastructure that can sustain it no matter how erratic things are or get externally. This model, the black church model, relies first on its own internal resources, ideologically, normatively, financially. Now, it adapts from other societal influences, but it has the ability and awareness of the need to develop its own culturally indigenous forms. One understands, I suspect, somewhat what I'm alluding to the extent, for instance, that one understands the functions and forms of, say, the Willing Workers Club of Big Bethel Baptist Church, or the Busy Bee Club of Tabernacle. I think that if one really wants to understand how some kinds of leadership cadre are developed in this particular institution in the black community, look at the Busy Bee Club of Tabernacle Baptist Church. Now, I certainly have no intention of overplaying the black church model, but I see it as a most useful point of departure for those who are seriously interested in talking about institution building in the black community in the United States. Some churches fail in full, no question about it, because of lack of funds or because of fussing. But the black church, as an institution, is alive and well and shouting. And I think secular institutions in the black community must begin to study this and to build on it. This might well be the kind of thing that the Panthers a couple of years ago, Huey Newton was talking about when he said that in a real sense, the Black Panthers defected from the black community when they defected from the black church. Now, I don't want to be misunderstood here in this first point. I'm really not talking about church or Christianity or anything like that. I think perhaps I have to make myself quite clear on that. I'm not talking about jackleg preachers or people who go to the church on Sunday for catharsis purpose. I'm not talking about anything like that. I'm talking about studying an institution in the black community that has survived from the moment blacks were on this land. And I think its survival and its forms, its adaptiveness, these things can teach us a great deal when we talk about developing culturally indigenous institutions in the black community. Parenthetically, I might add that I don't think that you learn terribly much, maybe so, but I doubt it, from Flip Wilson's church of what's happening now. That's hardly what I have reference to. I think it's necessary to begin to focus much more on our own indigenous sources of strength and development. In the final analysis, you see, whether you're talking about, in the context of the earlier study I mentioned, busing or community control or what have you, those black children in that third school, in that study, must be protected by their parents and the black community, who build into indigenous institutions our own normative values, and which will help black children combat and survive the clearly detrimental effects of established institutional onslaughts. I think there's already some of this activity going on. Very interested in institutions like the Institute of Positive Education in Chicago, and there are many others around the country. I think we must also recognize that these kinds of ventures of necessity will at first be relatively small. But this does not mean that they have to be unstable. Stability and viability need not be correlated with bigness. I realize that what I'm saying, I've been reminded of this on more than one occasion when I talk on this subject, but what I'm saying might sound a bit like what another fellow recently said: ask not what your government can do for you, but what you can do for yourself. Well, I hope you understand when I say any resemblance is purely coincidental, maybe. But the point is, in an institutionally racist society, and I believe it is, we don't hear much talk about it now, in an institutionally racist society, we would be well advised to start with ourselves. Not because this particular historical moment required it, but precisely because our future development demands it. I don't know any people in the history of this country, any group, that has developed without first getting its own self together. I just don't know any. I don't know any group. I don't care where they are on the socioeconomic scale now. I don't know any group that has struggled and made it, whatever that means, without first developing its own indigenous institutions and moving from that base. Now, we can talk integration and we can talk class struggle. We can talk all that talk. But I'm going to ask you ultimately to tell me any group in the history of this country, that has done it any other way. And so what I'm saying to you is what we said before in another place. I fundamentally believe that before any group can enter the open society, it had first better close ranks. I also believe, and you see this developing around now with all of these particularistically oriented approaches to the black problem. I also believe that there can be no such thing as, and I went to a conference in Washington recently, as a viable black child development. You've probably heard of that organization. Without what I consider to be co-equal attention and emphasis on black community development. I'm saying to you, the matter is one. It's not dichotomous. Institution building, then, is a comprehensive community affair, not a fragmented affair. Now, secondly, it's clear that the society will continue to allocate money, hard money, institutional capital, for certain functions, education, welfare, health services, whole host of. Certainly not as much as has been allocated recently, but considerable thought should be given to precisely how black communities should structure or restructure or order or reorder themselves to maximize use of those resources for collective benefit of black communities. I think that if there's any black community, for instance, in terms of recent policy, that is not gearing itself up as a community, as an organized community, to study its local government's projected plans or existing plans for dealing with revenue sharing, then that black community deserves to be left out in the cold. Because, you see, we cannot now wait for other people to do that for us. In fact, I would suggest to you that it's best they not do it for us. I want, in other words, to establish the point that the dependent mentality, the beggar syndrome, should be laid to rest. And that's what institution building means. Millions of dollars come now and will continue to come into black communities, public sector dollars. But that money, under present structural program arrangements, goes right out. Blacks, and I spoke on this earlier, the class, blacks serve as conduits in the American economic system. They conduct money from one segment of the economy to another. So when Theodore Draper or some of those other people take us to task for using the colonial analogy, I will say in no uncertain terms that, yes, we do live in and clearly live under a conduit colonial system. Let me give you an example. Let's not talk so much about welfare recipients, but let's talk about, for instance, welfare beneficiaries. Who really benefits from welfare? New York City alone pays $329 million per year to house welfare people. Who benefits from that money? Who gets that money? Very clear. Not the so-called recipients, but there's a new class I would identify for you. It's the welfare beneficiaries. The hotels, the welfare hotels, the slumlords, and so forth. And yet, you see, they get the bread, we get the blast. Because we are the lazy, shiftless ones. We get subsistence income, they get venture capital. We are conduits in this system, and if we continue, we blacks, I know y'all, some white folk out there, but I'm talking about black. If we continue to let this continue, then it is our fault. Let's not go blaming anybody else. And there's a point beyond which we can no longer rant and rave and moan and groan. The analysis is ours to make, the institutions are ours to construct, and the programs are ours to get on with. Nobody else's. And that really means mind-blowing time is done. It really means. Institution building should focus also on blocking the conduit colonial system, developing more efficacious ways to turn those resources now being expended into maximum use for black communities. And there are ways to talk about this. There are ways to mobilize around this. There are people beginning to deal with this. And when we talk about institution building, let's avoid a historical black mistake of separating the political from the economic. And let's avoid an historical black mistake of looking upon one particular thing, say the vote, as the panacea. We know terribly clearly, or we should know now, we've been around enough now, to know, on the one hand, that there simply is, it doesn't make any sense, and yet I'm frequently told or asked by people, well, don't you think the problem is really economic and not political? Well, listen, I tell that fool, how can you come to separate the two ever in this society? Blacks, in pursuing their programs, have effectively separated the political from the economic and vice versa. So that in Harlem, New York, where I work, we have in the 4.5 square mile area of Harlem today 206 community organizations by count. Over 90% of them on soft money, and over 85% of them tax exempt. Now I ask you, how in the hell can you talk about a viable socio-political economic movement on a tax-exempt status? It's a contradiction of terms. So, this period of austerity might well be a blessing in disguise. In the post-Reconstruction era, Black communities turned into themselves and sought strength within themselves. They built their institutions, namely the Black church. Lord knows they built that. They fought and ranted and raved and split, and that's when we got all those different Black Baptist denominations or groups. But they also had to rely on themselves, and they also came to understand what it meant to really live in a system of adversity. I sometimes believe, and I'm finishing up now, that the 60s was a soft period for us. In addition to being a prolific amount of soft money, we became highly disillusioned. And John Killen says, you can't be disillusioned unless you once had illusions. I think as we move from the specific programs to careful thoughts of building protracted institutions, it's going to be very clear that these institutions will reflect the cultural values and orientations of the people who form them if they would be viable and vital. I know a lot of people are terribly pessimistic today because of the national scene, the cutback in funds. Okay, that's fine. Program money. They seem to believe that this administration is almost invulnerable. Well, I'm going to tell you in a strange kind of way, I've never been more optimistic in my life, because I somehow believe that a people who can survive what they've laid on us so far in this country, this is almost a tea party. I understand. I understand that what's going to happen now is y'all going to ask me some questions. And my ground rules are very simple. I take the friendly and easy questions first, starting from the left. Okay, y'all go ahead now. Yes. Shouldn't we, yell so they can hear you now? I'll repeat it.
Do you see us moving to a front of the RNA would like to do?
Yeah, the comment was that in the book I did with Carmichael, we made the colonial analogy, and the normal definition, understanding of a colony was proceeding toward a nation, a sovereign nation, really. And do I see that in the winds or in the wings for blacks in this country after perhaps the RNA model, the Republic of New Africa model? No, I don't. No, I don't. I do not see blacks in this country developing to the point of sovereign nationalism in this country. I think that what we can point to as a people is a more sovereign and vibrant, vital Africa. But we will never be a sovereign entity, as far as I'm concerned, in this country. But we can pursue that if someone wants to discuss that. I'd be perfectly willing to pursue it. I just think it's for, in terms of the foreseeable historical future, it's unrealistic. Yes. Oh, of course, obviously.
Well, then, how could you, you had to, let's say, cut your ties with the white capitalist economy in order to break the ties with tendency? Where would your capital develop?
Well, first of all, we don't want to, there's no such thing as breaking one's ties. I'm not suggesting that. See, I pay taxes to this country. I want my fair share of return, see. I'm not going to break my, we'd be glad to break our ties, but in taxes, you know. So if you want to negotiate that, I'm willing to talk. And that's also a part of American history. Somebody else said something like that. No, I think that we have to be terribly understanding about this. What we're talking about is a situation that permits us to, on our own, beginning with our own initiative, to maximize our capacity to develop. That's what we're talking about. I think that, you see, we have to also be very clear about this. Most of the white folks in this country are hurting, too. They just don't understand it that way, you see. So I'm not going to get into that thing, because I suspect you've had two sessions of that. But there's a strange kind of thing that develops that, that I've seen happening. I've seen a lot of white Americans think that they've got it made. It's some strange sort of Leibnizian notion of this is the best of all possible worlds. It's very interesting. But at any rate, no, we're not talking about cutting our... It's very clear that this economy is undergoing changes. It's really very clear to me. And what we want to do, what I want to do, and I'm not going to speak for many, many other blacks, what I want to do is make sure that we can influence the direction of that change. But I wouldn't dare counsel black people to break their economic ties. I don't understand that, no. My God. But as I say now, if we're willing to talk. If you want to, you've put something else on the agenda. If you want to talk about reparations and ending of taxes to blacks for a period, yeah, that's an interesting point. I'll raise that next time. But don't you see what I'm getting at? How can we break our ties? We're intimately a part of this society.
How can what I was saying was, doesn't the fact you're intimately part of the system mean that your dependency must continue?
I don't see why. Why should that be? No, seriously, I want to.
Okay, because under development, the black community is a natural structural byproduct of your ties.
Well, maybe we can talk about an effective approach that tends to change that the nature of that economic system. Isn't that possible? I'm willing to talk about that. I think that's possible. For instance, I think it's possible to... you see, I'm prepared to deal in gross terms or very small terms. I think it's possible to change the whole land use situation in Harlem, for instance, which is not an inconsequential economic move. See, Right now, 16.5% of the property value in Harlem is owned by people who list their residencies as being in Harlem. The rest is external. Now, I think it's very critical for blacks who live in Harlem to acquire that property, acquire that land. Where will that lead you? Will that lead you to ultimate economic liberation? Hell no. Of course not. But I believe in the developmental process, it will certainly lead you to a better situation than you're in now. I'm not going to think absolutely and holistically with you. See, I'm prepared to stage it and phase it. There are many things that can be done. But you see, the burden of initiating those is on us as blacks. And I would agree with you, and unless we assume that burden, I would agree with the final thrust of your question, it will never be done. It will never be done. I think one of the most, and now I'll probably get a lot of blasting comments now, I think one of the most detrimental things that has happened to the black community has been the New Deal program and the Great Society program. We have created a welfare recipient industry class, and the society has developed a whole industry of colonial managers to service us. Now, careful analysis will tell you that that's absolutely what has happened. That's absolutely what has happened. Oh, yeah, we have to definitely. So I'm perfect. Okay, let's get into this whole discussion of cooperation and coalition and so forth. I'm perfectly prepared to say that, sure. But you see, it's very critical that I identify for you the ground rules under which I think a viable coalition has to proceed, from which it has to proceed. And if you examine it, you'll find that nowhere in the history of the black American have we ever lived up to these conditions. First of all, it's very clear to me that blacks, when properly organized themselves, should not at all fear entering into specific alliances on given issues. That's very clear to me. But under no circumstances do I ever perceive a permanent continuing alliance. That's silly. There's no such thing in politics. And you see, what I'm interested in is an alliance of co-equals. And in no time in the history of black America have we ever had that. At no time. And the reason it's critical that you have an alliance of co-equals, if it's going to be a viable alliance, is because if the other person in the alliance backs out, as the whites have so often done, we can punish them. Up to now, we haven't had the ability, and in some instances, the willingness, to punish whites who backed out on us. So it hasn't made sense to talk about in a buy it, rest in kind of way, coalition politics or somebody else kind of way. What the hell does a little powerless group, disorganized, look like trying to ally with a massive, powerful group? Machiavelli has something to say about that. Y'all read The Prince. So all that discussion of coalition and alliance politics is premature or foolish. And so I say to you, sure you're allied, but you co-equals coalesce. And then you see there's another condition. It is absolutely important, particularly when you talk about a political economic alliance, that you enter into alliances with those people who have some specific self-interest involved in that alliance and not some altruistic moral purpose. We're not interested in that.
We have confused all that. We used to lock arms and sing, "We Shall Overcome," and we immediately left the room saying, "We've got ourselves an alliance going." That's nonsense. And so blacks have been terribly, terribly misled by themselves in interpreting the altruism and the moralism of some of their friends, their white friends, as a viable political alliance. Now that's silly. It's naive. And so, of course, if you want to talk alliances, first, let's find out what you want to talk about, what kind of issue you're dealing with. And secondly, let me identify the forces that are going to be involved in that alliance. Bayard Rustin, you know, wants to take us into an alliance with labor, AFL-CIO. Where is the AFL-CIO on the Philadelphia plan, the New York plan, the Chicago plan? And what is he what kinds of forces is he taking into the labor alliance anyway? We talked about the old civil rights alliance between labor, civil rights groups, and you know, the religious groups and liberal groups and so forth. Examine the constituencies there. How many votes could Martin Luther King deliver, even if he wanted to? Now, we've got to be very honest with ourselves that what we've had up to now in terms of alliances have been letterhead organizations. And if you want to talk very serious about political coalitions and political alliances, then you won't drag up that. Sure, we can deal with alliances. But not the kind we've had historically in black political history. Yes. Well, I certainly believe that it is inaccurate to say that a great deal of what happened, say, in the 60s was all for naught. That is strictly an overstatement, and one should not make that statement. I think, incidentally, that the most significant thing of all the things that happened in the 60s was the Voting Rights Act of 65. If you had to ask me about one, I think that would be the most significant. Now, but I think that what I meant in my last statement was simply that, sure, there was a lot of things done. We haven't been able to assess yet the impact of a lot of those programs. Head Start, we know a lot about the benefits and burdens of, say, a lot of the manpower training programs. The housing programs, sure. But you see, I made my statement predicated on the fact that I can almost guarantee you that nothing institutionally in terms of building social bases of development and power in black communities is going to come out of those things. And I think, therefore, that I, as one who took part in those programs, as one who pushed those programs, and so I'm being, you know, I'm not rising above this thing, I'm being self condemning as well. I think that we permitted ourselves to be misled but that was an easy thing to do. We all lived through the 60s. you know, we could see great things happening. And now I'm simply passing judgment from the vantage point of 1973. And I think that all of that happened, we're still going to have to start almost from scratch now and turn within ourselves and begin to build out from our own strengths. Anybody out there? Just first. A model.
Yeah. Would you think that the movement would be a better model?
That's a church. That's a church. That's a religious organization. It's a church. See, don't you? When I say black church, I don't mean black Christian church. The Nation of Islam is a church, isn't it? Ask Minister Farrakhan when he comes here. Sure, it's a church. See, I'm not going to make a distinction between the Nation of Islam and Reverend Joseph Jackson's National Baptist Convention. But I don't want to stop you. Did you have something to lead from that?
No, I have another question.
Okay, go ahead.
Mm.
And the AMEs might be better than the Baptists, too, because they're hierarchical, sure. No, no. Listen, brother. Okay, well, I'll put him at the top, too. I just don't want to get involved. No. But you get my point about the black church generically understood as a better model, as a good model. And I take that back. If any Baptists, and I don't know if the AMEs are better than the Baptists. That's not important.
The second question I had, since you wrote the book Black Power, Carmichael, I'm wondering, because I'm baffled on this, how does your political assessment and position differ from Carmichael's now?
Well, Carmichael, if he'd come here tonight, would have talked exclusively, I think, about Pan-Africanism and the need to gear your every conscious effort at this moment toward the ultimate fulfillment of a Pan-Africa. I didn't do that. I happen to agree with that, but I think that our emphasis right now, he would emphasize things that I won't emphasize and vice versa. I think that fundamentally we don't agree in the small print or in the big print. It's just that he chooses probably to say things, other things on the platform that I choose to say. That's about all. Of course, Carmichael and I always had some disagreements, but nothing fundamental. He always thought James Brown was a good singer, and I never did. Of course. Then it's our fault, that's all. So, possibly. Possibly. No. They bought off that earlier institutional effort by integration. That's what bought it off now. They didn't pass any laws against our institutions. We developed national black lawyers associations because we couldn't get into the ABA. We developed viable black medical associations because we couldn't get into AMA. But the moment those organizations began to open our doors, we immediately felt it a sin to keep our black organizations, which were viable and growing. No, they didn't pass any laws. They lured us away with the carrot of integration, and we misunderstood it. No, I'm very serious about that. You know that. I'm very serious. They lured us by saying we have to be integrated and forget our own values and institutions, or we are separatists.
Wow.
Well, of course. Sure. Well, I hope it... Yes, I understand. I hope it comes out of the sheer viability of your own institutions so that you won't feel a need to be lured away. Definitely. Definitely. Do you remember in the early 60s, there was a brief moment there when they attended, and this is very important. Remember in the early 60s, well, let's date it about 61, 62, we began to sit in the South in churches. Do you remember that, the sit in the churches? Come on, you remember that. We could build a mass community effort in the South around everything.